Chapter 22 Good Stewardship, New Icons. As a young man growing up in New Hampshire, my heroes, like those of everyone I knew, were people whose accomplishments made the world a better place for future generations. My friends and I wanted to follow in the footsteps of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Tom Paine, Harriet Tubman, Thomas Edison, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Florence Nightingale, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and, among soldiers, Dwight D. Eisenhower. We honored them not because they lived in big houses or accumulated wealth, but because they were dedicated to noble causes. In history classes, we were taught that although men like John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan paved the way for industrialization, they were not the sort of people we wanted to emulate. They were portrayed as greedy, mean-spirited, and selfish. Professor Ashton and his business school colleagues substantiated these beliefs in the late 1960s when they taught that corporate executives are fiduciary stewards charged with safeguarding long-term corporate interests. The laws enacted after the Great Depression codified this concept. Had the country continued honoring such beliefs in recent decades, we would not be suffering from today's economic calamity. Unfortunately, powerful people and interest groups pushed us in the opposite direction, and we went willingly. We made icons of the likes of Donald Trump, a ruthless real estate developer who publicly glorifies the firing and humiliation of people on TV, and Jack Welch, the former chairman and CEO of GE, who bragged about laying off one quarter of his company's employees while paying himself multi-million dollar salaries and bonuses and denying that CO2 polluting industries were seriously impacting the environment. We plaster the faces of billionaires on the covers of our magazines and praise them for donating fortunes to charity without bothering to point out that they made many times these fortunes by beating down their competitors. We watch shows about the rich and famous, and in so doing, send messages to our children that they should aspire to living in mansions and traveling in private jets, regardless of how much environmental and social havoc is caused in the process. We display bumper stickers on our cars proclaiming, "He who dies with the most toys wins." During the past four decades, we the people have sent a strong message of support to the modern equivalent of the robber barons. We have let the executives know that we want them to provide us with inexpensive goods and high rates of return on our stocks. We have rewarded those CEOs who maximized profits regardless of the cost. Is that what we really want? There is every indication that it is not, at least not any longer. The 2008 presidential election was symbolic in this regard. A major reason John McCain received the Republican nomination was because he had been viewed for years as a maverick and a decent, honest, selfless man who had chosen to remain a North Vietnamese prisoner of war rather than be released before his comrades because his father was a U.S. Navy admiral. When, during the campaign, people tried to entice McCain to proclaim that an Obama victory would cripple the country, he refused to do that. Obama ultimately won in large part because his platform presented a different, more magnanimous perspective than that offered by the Republicans. In recent years, we have witnessed many encouraging trends. Consumers are now sending messages that refute the old ones. We are saying that we want our leaders to look beyond profits, to provide goods and services that foster a better world. Many businesses are responding accordingly. Companies like Whole Foods and Publix GreenWise stores have proven that selling organically grown foods can be profitable. Novo Nordisk AS, a Danish pharmaceutical company, is mission-oriented toward ridding the world of diabetes. Grupo Nueva of Chile has a goal of creating a sustainable Latin America. Grameen Danone Foods, a 50-50 joint venture between Group Danone, the $16 billion multinational yogurt maker, and the Grameen Group, an offshoot of the Grameen Microcredit Bank, founded by Nobel Peace Laureate Muhammad Yunus, provides affordable nutrition to malnourished children in Bangladesh as well as employment for their parents. Google.org has led the way into for-profit philanthropy. Member-owned cooperatives have recently become a planet-encompassing business with more than 800 million members, double the number in the 1980s. We are poised to enter a new era. Growing numbers of us recognize that it is time to stop honoring people who perpetuate a greedy, materialistic mentality, to cease buying magazines that feature their faces on the covers, and to switch off TV programs that try to convince us that squandering resources is something to be admired. It is time to turn the Fortune 500 into a list of those corporations and NGOs that best serve the planet and future generations. In 2005, when I dined with MBA students before my speeches at their schools and asked them to describe their goals, nearly all of them talked about making money and attaining power. In the fall of 2008 and the first half of 2009, I did not hear one student speak like this. Not one MBA student from Stanford, Columbia, Wharton, the University of Michigan, Ohio State, Boston University, Harvard, Antioch, or the China-Europe International Business School. Nor did I hear it from undergraduate students at Olivet College, Regis University, St. John's University, William Patterson University, or Wilmington College. Attitudes had changed in just 3 years. Not a single student who attended those dinners and other meetings with me listed as his or her goal the accumulation of either wealth or power. What they said instead was that they wanted to help create a better world. Many of them wondered aloud why we do not demand more prime-time television shows about men and women who have founded and run our nonprofits. They suggested that such programs could include adventures in exotic locations, office intrigues, romance, sex, and eccentric characters who would be a whole lot more fun to watch than Donald Trump. Several students pointed out that the recent flurry of shows like American Idol are popular precisely because they glorify previously unknown people who have talent. In a way, they are throwbacks to Ted Mack's original Amateur Hour and Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts that gained popularity in the 1940s and 1950s, times when we seemed to place more value on ordinary people. A lot of students told me they were considering joining the Peace Corps or AmeriCorps, or planning on spending a year or two volunteering at nonprofit organizations. A country's values may well be reflected in the images of its idols. That would explain the popularity, after World War II, of cowboy heroes who protected the defenseless against gunslingers and rancher barons. It would explain our obsession with wealth during a period when the leading economic theorist defined the sole objective of business as the maximization of profits. The corollary may also be true. The heroes we choose guide our young people into making decisions about how they will lead their lives. If we assume that either or both of these is the case, we can understand the importance at this point in history of honoring men and women who stand for a compassionate worldview. It is significant that two of the presidents leading Latin America into this new epoch are women, in Argentina and Chile, that many of the male presidents have committed to including a large percentage of women in their governments, and that during the 2008 U.S. presidential elections, Hillary Clinton was runner-up for the Democratic nomination and Sarah Palin was the Republican's vice presidential candidate. Statistics show, in most cases, that when women gain positions of power, greater emphasis is placed on the nurturing aspects of society and less on the militaristic ones. Police and defense budgets decrease, and so do violence and crime rates. In Women, Power, and the Biology of Peace, Dr. Judith Hand points out that men often see war as an opportunity to spread their sperm, one of their biological imperatives. On the other hand, for women, war is a threat to the home, stability, and child raising. Women want peace and stability. Dr. Hand contends that in order for us to enjoy more peaceful societies, women must play larger roles in the decision-making processes. Dr. Rian Eisler's book, The Real Wealth of Nations, concludes that in societies where women are respected as leaders and women make up a larger percentage of the government, such as in some of the northern European countries, more funding is allocated to health care, high-quality child care, education, and generously paid parental leaves. She states, "When the status and power of women is higher, so also is a nation's quality of life, and when it is lower, so is the quality of life for all." Abandoning our preoccupation with material wealth and profits and elevating ourselves to a more empathetic worldview will require embracing feminine characteristics that foster peaceful communities and sustainable economies. More of our cultural icons in the future will be women, and also men who reflect the nurturing aspects of leadership. It is up to us to reverse the process that sprang out of the mutant virus of capitalism that infected our economy. It is up to us to encourage an acceleration of the recent trends, to let our leaders know that what we truly want is wholesome food, clean water and air, accessible health care, the assurance that we will be provided for after retirement, legal systems that protect us and our rights. In short, a peaceful, just, and sustainable world. We want this for ourselves, our children, and for every person on our planet. The hour has come for us to honor and reward those men and women who strive to achieve these goals. Such leaders will understand the need to reinstate rules that protect against the abuses that resulted in the current economic crises. They will also recognize the necessity of going beyond this and instituting for the first time in history regulations that establish as priorities a sustainable environment and a just and peaceful world for the future. Chapter 23. New Rules for Business and Government. Two Shuar men, Shakim and Twitza, and I hiked into the Kutuku Mountains. We struggled up muddy slopes, forded shoulder-deep rivers, and hacked our way through the massive branches of a gigantic kapok tree that had fallen across the trail. Finally, we stood below the sacred waterfall. As it cascaded out of the mists, it created a rainbow that, according to a Shuar legend, birthed the first man and woman. Late in the afternoon, my companions taught me a traditional ceremony for honoring the water. That night, wrapped in blankets beneath a makeshift lean-to, we listened quietly to the growls of a passing jaguar. The next afternoon, on our way back, only an hour away from their community, Shakim raised his arm, signaling for us to stop. He and Twitza stepped off the trail. They squatted beside a small plant, examined it, and exchanged words. Shakim cupped his hands around the plant and blew gently into it. Twitza looked up at me. "It's sick," he explained, pointing at the leaves. "It was healthy yesterday," Shakim added, "when we came along this trail." He stood up. "We have to report this to the elders." They resumed walking. I stood there gawking at that plant. I could see nothing exceptional about it, no reason why these men would have noticed it in the first place. A couple of leaves had turned brown and fallen to the ground, but that did not seem sufficient cause for concern. That night, I received an education. Shakim, Twitza, and their families gathered around a fire with other members of the community. They described in detail the state of the plant on the morning when we headed up to the waterfall, and the changes that had occurred during the ensuing 36 hours. Their accounts were followed by lengthy discussions. The circle of participants paid particularly close attention to an old lady who was highly respected for her ability to prepare healing herbs. She suggested that the plant had delivered a message. The trail was overused. A vote was taken. Although several people pointed out that there could have been other causes for the sickness, the decision was unanimous. If there was any possibility that people were contributing to the problem, then people had to take remedial action. A new rule was adopted for the entire community. That trail would be closed. Outside the ceremonial lodge, Shekem and I stood in the clearing and peered up at the starry night. "Interesting how different our regulations are from yours," he said, as though hearing my question before I had a chance to verbalize it. "The priests make rules about who can have sex. The school has a law that children have to wear shoes." He paused. "But they don't say anything about not killing birds during mating season or abandoning trails when plants get sick." He pointed to the heavens. "How long do you think those stars would exist if the god who put them there was as short-sighted as the priests and schools?" I thought of that experience a month later, when I was back in the States, where the idea of imposing greenhouse gas emissions limits on corporations was being debated by politicians and the media. The opposition argued that there was no absolute proof that CO2 caused climate change. The contrast between the way the Shuar and the leaders of my country dealt with the world was striking. The primitive rainforest tribe did not require 100% certainty. It neither equivocated nor allowed short-term inconveniences to get in the way. If current actions might possibly threaten future generations, they regulated against them. As populations and economies grow, one might expect the laws governing our relationship to the environment and society to become more stringent. Faced with greater demands for resources, it makes sense to charge some international governing body with the task of ensuring that they are allocated wisely. From a rational standpoint, protecting against the wanton destruction and depletion of things essential to our lives deserves the highest priority. However, the exact opposite has happened. Recent scandals, beginning with Enron and continuing to Bernard Madoff and much of the financial community, prove that many of our most respected business people have acted irresponsibly. These scandals and the coinciding economic turmoil demonstrate that we cannot afford to place our resources and our children's futures in the hands of unregulated mercenaries. The undermining of organizations and laws that once protected the public interest has been disastrous. Some of the most obvious and onerous examples discussed previously in this book include the deregulation of the energy, transportation, communications, banking, finance, and insurance sectors, the abandonment of caps on usurious interest rates, the acceptance of false accounting standards that exclude externalities, the creation of international agreements such as NAFTA, CAFTA, and other free market zones around the globe that have promoted licenses to plunder, the imposition of structural adjustment programs, SAPs, on other nations and the resulting privatization of their resources. To illustrate that, in Shuar terms, we have killed mating birds and continued to utilize trails that are annihilating ecosystems. Fortunately, the calamitous consequences are forcing us to finally understand our folly. Even some of the most conservative economists now conclude that deregulation and the other strategies that gave businesses unprecedented freedoms are major factors contributing to the worst recession since the 1930s, and that rules governing corporations serve an essential function. Rather than inhibiting economic expansion, such a body of regulations establishes parameters for long-term growth. We have seen that executives are human and capable of succumbing to the temptation of abusing their powers. On the other hand, history demonstrates that when rules mandate serving the common good, corporations and their bosses do exactly that. Perhaps no public figure was more aware of this than Teddy Roosevelt. He assumed the presidency in 1901 after a financial collapse that was caused by corporate abuses, mass mergers, and the robber barons who had sought and won deregulation. He dissolved monopolistic corporations and pushed through laws that regulated the railroads and other industries. Roosevelt had little tolerance for business and government leaders who were not committed to the common good. In a Labor Day speech delivered in 1903, he said, The death knell of the Republic had rung as soon as the active power became lodged in the hands of those who sought not to do justice to all citizens, rich and poor alike, but to stand for one special class and for its interests as opposed to the interests of others. He recognized the dangers of unregulated businesses and of executives who were driven solely by a desire to increase their power and profits. Roosevelt's Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, Edmund Morris, speculated about actions Roosevelt might take if he occupied the White House today. He would want to do something about Microsoft, since he had been passionate about monopoly from the moment he entered politics. Although no single trust 100 years ago approached the monolithic immensity of Mr. Gates' empire, the Northern Securities merger of 1901 created the greatest transport combine in the world, controlling commerce from Chicago to China. T.R. busted it. In doing so, he burnished himself with instant glory as the champion of American individual enterprise against corporate malefactors of great wealth. Roosevelt understood, however, that clamping down on greedy business operators was only the first step. The process of regulation had to go beyond that. In addition to the triage necessary to cure the nation's economic ills, he believed that government had a responsibility to protect future generations. He called for a national health plan and advocated a strategy to ensure that citizens would forever be the beneficiaries of the country's natural resources. In a move the Shuar would undoubtedly applaud, he created the Bureau of Forestry and signed into existence 5 new national parks, 18 national monuments, and millions of acres of national forest. We know now what Roosevelt knew then, that recovery from severe economic turmoil requires long-term innovation. The solutions must include responses that endure for decades to come. Reinstating the types of regulations that for more than half a century protected us from another 1929 crash is essential. Yet it is not sufficient. The world has changed radically since the time of the Great Depression. Global populations have more than tripled. The depletion of resources has increased at accelerating rates, as has pollution, toxicity, and species extinctions. Ships' crews discover huge garbage dumps in the middle of the oceans. Astronauts confront it in outer space. Every living system is in decline, and every one of them is declining at ever-increasing speeds. Today we are awash in a sea of problems so severe that they have pushed us to the brink of disaster. Although we need the modern equivalent of the Glass-Steagall Act, the Bank Holding Company Act, and so many of the others that were dropped after 1980, we must not stop there. This nation deserves a whole new set of rules and regulations that ensure a sustainable, just, and peaceful world for my grandson and all his brothers and sisters everywhere. It deserves an accounting system that internalizes the externalities, and in doing so, ensures that the most socially and environmentally responsible businesses enjoy a competitive edge over others, instead of vice versa. The cancer that lurks beneath this economic crisis will not be cured by merely addressing the problems of the banking, insurance, and auto industries. Like a patient after his cancerous lung has been removed, who must quit smoking if he wants a healthy life, our long-term health depends on addressing the underlying causes. The goal of maximizing profits, regardless of environmental and social costs, must become a relic of history. Barack Obama's election as president signaled that a majority of voters rejected the principles that had determined U.S. policy for more than a third of a century. His calls for a credit card holder's Bill of Rights that imposes tighter regulation on the credit card industry, along with tougher rules on auto emissions and mileage, and a new regulatory commission to oversee financial products and services, including banks, mortgage providers, and mutual funds, all of these measures indicate an important philosophical shift. The danger is that we will become so wrapped up in debates over these and other issues that focus on the current economic crises that we will forget to address the systemic problems. There is the very real possibility that partisan politics and special interests will distract us from enacting the types of laws that would rid us once and for all of the mutant virus and offer instead a healthy form of capitalism. We must not let that happen. We cannot afford to be lulled into complacency or allow indicators of good news like temporary increases in the stock market, lower oil prices, and payoffs of loans by bailed-out banks to soothe us into believing that things have returned to normal. It is essential to keep in mind that normal led us into this disaster, and it will quickly propel us into a much worse one, despite the possibility of short-term recoveries, unless we change the parameters. The old normal, where 5% of the globe's people consume 25% of its resources and half the population verges on starvation, must be rejected. A true replacement is called for. Our planet shouts at us to take bold steps. Let us, the voters, the consumers, the ones whose children will have to live with the policies implemented right now, insist that our leaders show the courage to truly lead. Most of us consider the legislation of rules and regulations to be the job of our elected officials. While technically this is true, those officials look to us to guide their decisions. As consumers, it is our job to let the corporations know that we want better controls. As voters, it is our responsibility to demand legislation that protects us and our progeny from the types of abuses that are causing so much suffering around the planet today. We have the power to make it happen. The only requirement, that we focus on our individual passions and talents. Chapter 24. Honoring Your Passion. If there had been more space in the Politico.com webpage, I would have told the story that Hillary Clinton told me when I met with her in the White House. When FDR met with labor leaders in 1934, after 4 hours of meeting, he said the following: "You've convinced me that you are right. Now, go out there and force me to do it." What he meant, Hillary explained to me, was that the pressures on a president to stay with the status quo and the forces of the economic and political elites of the country are enormous, so that even when a president wishes to move in a different direction, he needs to be able to point to forces from the progressive world that are equally vociferous and pushing him in the direction he wished to go. Source: a note from Rabbi Michael Lerner entitled "Obama's Non-Ideological Pragmatism Will Backfire," discussing an article he published on www.politico.com on May 20, 2009. A theme repeated throughout this book is that we the people must make it happen. We have to look to ourselves to create a sustainable, just, and peaceful planet. The point Hillary Clinton made to Rabbi Lerner is exactly that. We cannot sit back and expect President Obama or anyone else to rescue us. Our political leaders count on us to demand that they do the right thing. Abraham Lincoln eloquently admonished us to make sure that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth in his Gettysburg Address. Such a government requires active participation from its citizens, or it will perish. What is true for politicians is also true for business leaders. They may try to influence our shopping habits through various promotional methods, but in the end, we make the decisions. The success or failure of their businesses depends on us. FDR's advice to the unions about how they should push, help him, applies to us and corporate executives as well. We need to hear their plea: force me to do it. An essential ingredient in all of this is passion. In order for those labor leaders to get through to FDR, they had to be moved by passion. Lincoln recognized that he had to fire the nation's passions. His famous address ended in an emotional call for impassioned action. "It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom." Passion has made the difference throughout history. It won the American Revolution, carried the day at Normandy, spurred the civil rights movement. Passion, by definition, is an intense or overpowering emotion such as love, joy, hatred, or anger. And Carta World English Dictionary. The important point for each of us as individuals is to recognize our passions, whether we consider them positive, such as love and joy, or negative, like hatred and anger, and then to direct the energy they generate in ways that affect the results we desire. Case in point, Rainforest Action Network, RAN, has convinced some of the world's most powerful companies, including Bank of America, Boise Cascade, Citigroup, Chase, Home Depot, Kinko's, and Staples, to change their policies toward cutting trees. A few years back, RAN went up against the Mitsubishi corporate family, at the time considered one of the world's most destructive loggers of tropical forests. In a bitter campaign, a Mitsubishi executive faced off against RAN's founder, Randy Hayes. Ultimately, RAN emerged victorious. Mitsubishi companies signed an agreement that committed them to ecological sustainability and social responsibility, and they pledged to implement 14 specific steps for fulfilling their commitment. Several months later, I attended a weekend conference in California, along with both the Mitsubishi executive and Randy. Following an initial rather stiff greeting, they studiously avoided each other. Late Saturday afternoon, Randy and I decided to head up to a hot tub at the top of a cliff overlooking the Pacific, share a few beers, and exchange stories about our adventures in the Amazon. We were shocked to find someone else already there. The Mitsubishi executive grinned awkwardly up from the bubbles, raised his own beer, and invited us to join him. I have to admit that I felt very nervous. Here I was, perched high above the Pacific, alone except for two other men who had been archenemies, naked, in a hot tub, drinking beer. I wondered what would happen next. After some small talk about the conference, the Mitsubishi executive raised his can and said to Randy, "I need to thank you." He went on to explain that he and other people at Mitsubishi had wanted to change company policies toward forests, but they had not dared to for fear of losing their jobs. "Your protesters and ads forced the issue," he continued. "Someone pointed out that our responsibility shouldn't stop with today's stockholders. They should include the stockholders' kids, our kids." RAN gave us an opportunity. We convinced ourselves, our company, to do the right thing. As the three of us continued talking, the executive kept referring to the passion of the RAN people. "That's what impressed me most," he said. "The zeal, the fervor of those individuals, young and old. We all felt it. It was contagious." Many of those volunteers were extremely angry at Mitsubishi for cutting forests. However, rather than directing this negative energy at something destructive, for example, hurling Molotov cocktails at corporate headquarters, or self-destructive, such as anesthetizing themselves with drugs or alcohol, they channeled their collective emotions into activities that achieved their desired results. Their enthusiasm persuaded one of the world's most powerful conglomerates to change its policies. Since then, I have heard many similar stories. One person's passion can move other people to transform themselves, or, in the case of executives, their corporations. This is especially true when the other people, or executives, know deep in their hearts that they want change. And today, we all understand that we desire something vastly different from this world of predatory capitalism. Whether in the Oval Office or a corporate boardroom, men and women in decision-making positions do not want climate change to sink Florida beneath the ocean. Nor do they want any of the other ill effects caused by pollution, the wanton depletion of resources, and abusive labor practices. However, until they are pushed, they feel powerless. The heartfelt commitment of consumers and activists is their tipping point. "Passion has changed my life," Lynn Twist told a group of us. The founder of the Soul of Money Institute, whose mission is to empower people to realign the acquisition and allocation of financial resources with their most passionately held values, and author of the best-selling book, The Soul of Money, Lynn followed her passions and moved to Ecuador in early 2008 with her husband, Bill. I had taken the two of them to that country in the early 1990s, and as a result, they founded the Pachamama Alliance, TPA, a nonprofit organization that works closely with indigenous people and is dedicated to preserving the Earth's rainforests and to creating a new global vision of equity and sustainability for people everywhere. She, Bill, and TPA's staff in Ecuador coordinated a successful campaign with the Ecuadorian government and other NGOs to include in Ecuador's new constitution a groundbreaking legal concept that grants fundamental rights to nature and the natural environment. Now, 4 months later, Lynn had led a group of TPA supporters deep into the Amazon to celebrate the new year with the Achuar tribe. We were floating casually down a river, watching a pod of pink dolphins that was swimming nearby and had apparently assembled to watch us. The passions of so many Ecuadorians is what made this amazing constitution possible, Lynn continued. The enthusiasm, drive, and talents of President Rafael Correa, combined with those of indigenous leaders, created a true miracle, one that will serve as a model for other countries and future generations for years to come. It is fair to say that passion is behind every major event. It has been the driving force of history. However, for it to be truly effective, passion requires something else that Lynn alluded to, talent. And just as each of us has passion, we also have special talents, personality traits, skills, and other abilities developed over the years. The real secret to changing the world, or for that matter, being successful at anything, is to apply our talents in ways that satisfy our passions. To cite a personal example, my passion for writing started when I was an only child growing up in rural New Hampshire as a means of dealing with loneliness. I had a deep admiration for authors who took a stand, like Paine, Jefferson, Thoreau, and many of the columnists I read in newspapers. I became editor-in-chief of my prep school paper, and I fought for changes in the school's draconian disciplinary policies. Writing offered a way to redirect the anger I felt over injustices committed in South Africa, Selma, Alabama, and on Indian reservations, as well as at my school. It moved me away from self-destructive actions into activities that could generate change. Today I am most happy when I write to promote worthy causes. Passion is powerful. It is infectious. It drives the world. One person's passion quickly spreads. Name people who have influenced you in literature, music, painting, theater, sports, or politics, and you will find they have applied their talents in ways that promoted their passions. Ordinary people filled with passion accomplish extraordinary tasks. Growing up in New Hampshire, I had no idea that African Americans had to ride in the back of the bus in some parts of my country, until Rosa Parks showed me and mobilized a civil rights movement that became global. I had no idea that the DDT we sprayed on the marsh behind our house to control mosquitoes also killed fish, birds, and squirrels until Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. I was pushed around by a bully until my third grade teacher, Mrs. Schneer, convinced me to stand up to him, which taught me about courage and the importance of not allowing others to get away with abusive behavior. I did not appreciate the powerful impact Tom Paine's common sense had on American colonists until I studied with a high school English teacher named Richard Davis, or that George Washington and John Hancock, two of the wealthiest men in the colonies, would have been hanged as traitors if we had lost the Revolution, until I listened to a history teacher named Jack Woodbury. All these people followed their own paths. Their only shared traits were that they all had passion, and they were all talented teachers in one way or another. They impacted people. Some made the history books. Of those who did not, Schneer, Davis, and Woodbury, I personally can say that, without them, I would not have written these pages. We can be grateful that Paine did not try to lead armies and Washington did not write pamphlets. The former had a passion and talent for pamphlet writing, the latter for leading men. Ardent women like Martha Washington organized themselves into groups to make clothes for soldiers on the front lines. Hunters became sharpshooters. Fishermen joined the fledgling navy. Along the way, their example motivated others. They were all teachers, inspirations to future generations. You, too, have passion and talents. You are a teacher. You can inspire. The opportunity is there every time you speak to anyone, purchase something or choose not to, or send an email. You teach through words and actions. The questions for you are these. What are your passions, talents? What will bring you the greatest sense of accomplishment, satisfaction, and joy? Whether you are a student, dentist, plumber, housewife, or something else, you can talk to your friends, family, and clients about the issues. Join organizations that represent your passions. Send emails. Use materials that are environmentally and socially responsible. Support politicians who take actions oriented to benefit future generations. Vote in the marketplace for companies committed to doing the right thing and accomplish objectives you have dared only to dream about until now. It all starts with recognizing your power. You initiate it by knowing that you have the ability to sit at the front of a bus, inspire a young person to stand up to a bully, and talk about the courage of our founding fathers and mothers. Like every one of your personal heroes, you sometimes hesitate, falter, make mistakes, and learn from your errors. You, too, can change the world. Commit to honoring your passion and acknowledging your power. When you combine yours with the passions and talents of everyone else who reads this page, miracles will happen. Together, we can create a world that is free of the mutant virus. Like Parks, Carson, Paine, the Washingtons, Schneer, Davis, Woodbury, the hunters, and the fishermen, we can each walk a separate path. The important thing is that we all head toward the same destination. A sustainable, just, and peaceful world. Conclusion. You've played around in the Amazon, Omar Torrijos chided me late one afternoon in 1978, as we strolled outside Panama's presidential palace along an ancient wall built to defend the city against pirates. But you haven't experienced real jungle until you've tried to hack your way through... He pointed across the bay, the Darien Gap. I could see nothing but water and a low, misty coastline, but I knew it was there, off in the distance, beyond my vision, a vast green jumble of vegetation. In those days, the Darien stretched over the mountains and swamps that separate Colombia from Panama, South America from Central America. All my life, I had heard it described in ominous terms, a dense rainforest of nightmarish perils, a mysterious no-man's land crawling with deadly bushmaster pit vipers, jaguars, crocodiles, and hostile natives. the only spot between northern Alaska and the southern tip of Argentina the Pan American Highway had not penetrated. Even Noriega, Torrijos continued, referring to his chief of military intelligence, isn't crazy enough to go in on foot. He hunts wild boars in the Darién from a helicopter. Now, more than three decades after that conversation with Omar, I was driving through the impenetrable Darién, totally shocked by the devastation surrounding me. It was July 2009, and the luxuriant rainforest that previously covered tens of thousands of square miles had disappeared. In its place were scattered pastures populated by scrawny herds of cattle. The once pristine rivers reeked of cow manure. The eroded hillsides oozed mud. I had been told that all that remained of contiguous jungle was a mere 12 miles at the point where the Pan American Highway will likely soon connect Panama and Colombia. The rest had been ravaged by cattle ranchers and lumber companies, the wild animals butchered by poachers. Torrijos had been assassinated, and Noriega was rotting in a U.S. prison. Until now, what has saved that last patch, Nathan Gray, my driver and host, advised me, is that the United Nations claims that it's the only barrier preventing hoof and mouth disease from spreading out of South America to the north. I peered through the windshield in the direction of that remaining remnant, a mirage that faded into the horizon. A microcosm for a world created by predatory capitalists, I murmured. Nathan shot me a look but said nothing as he maneuvered his four-wheel drive pickup truck along the muddy dirt road. It struck me that this man beside me was the opposite of those predatory capitalists. Nathan Gray represented the new type of capitalists who collectively are leading us away from the mutant virus that has brought us to the precipice of economic collapse. He and the others bear the torches that illuminate a path toward a healthier form of capitalism based on creating an ecologically sustainable planet. I recalled another day with Omar Torrijos. We were standing at the rail of a yacht docked at Contadora Island when he introduced me to the two words that had come to represent the people who have driven our economy to ruins. He warned that unless we stopped the predatory capitalists, global markets would go into shock, and he added, "Don't allow yourself to be hoodwinked." I had fallen into the trap. Most of us had. It appeared that Nathan Gray was one of the few who had never been hoodwinked. He was a founder in 1973 of Oxfam America, a highly acclaimed international assistance organization based in Boston. He started the nonprofit Earth Train in 1990 as an international youth leadership training organization that promotes community development in third world countries and that also pioneered partnerships between nonprofits and for-profits as a way to raise money from socially conscious investors. In 2001, along with Rainforest Capital LLC, a socially conscious investment company, the Kuna General Congress, representing the indigenous culture, the Fundación Danilo Pérez, founded by the Grammy-winning Panamanian jazz musician, the Biomuseo of Panama, and a number of individual Panamanians, Nathan established the Mamani Valley Preserve in what had once been rainforest on the edge of the Darién province. Emilio Mariscal tapped my shoulder. Sitting behind Nathan in the pickup truck's two-seater cabin, he was the preserve's director of agroforestry. "Over there," he said, "is one of my teams of planters." He pointed at a half-dozen men off in the distance, bent over, tenderly placing saplings into the earth. Emilio is a highly regarded forestry and sustainable agriculture expert who served from 2002 to 2007 as a lead field coordinator for the Native Species Reforestation Project in Panama, a program of Harvard University's Center for Tropical Forest Science, the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, and the Yale School of Forestry. "How many planters do you have?" asked Lynn Roberts, who was sitting beside Emilio. She is the director of Dream Change, a nonprofit I founded back in the early 1990s that is dedicated to preserving indigenous wisdom and shifting global consciousness. Lynn has lived and worked with indigenous people in Asia and in Central and South America, teaches workshops on transformation, and is the author of several books, including The Good Remembering and Shamaic Reiki. Nathan had asked her and Dream Change to spearhead the spiritual branch of Earth Train and to facilitate the inclusion of local indigenous cultures, the Embera and Kuna, into its Panamanian programs. 12 right now, Emilio answered. We'll plant 30,000 trees this year, all native species that will bring this place back in a decade or so. That hollow, Nathan interjected, pointing at an indentation in the scrubby pasture off to our left, used to be a wetland, swarming with migratory birds. Once the trees reestablish themselves, the wetlands will regenerate and the birds will return. Today, this preserve encompasses 10,000 acres, but it is positioned to protect over 150,000 acres of biologically diverse lands in Kuna territory. He had explained to me during previous telephone conversations that the land purchases were capitalized through private investments. The business model for this preserve is a creative combination of international private sector financing, community development, environmental research, and grassroots organization. We're not trying to drive local people off the land, Nathan continued as we bounced through potholes. Without preaching, we're quietly demonstrating to these cattle ranchers that they'll be far better off allowing this land to go back to rainforest and selling its natural products sustainably. Hardwoods, fruits, vegetables, orchids, ornamentals, ground covers, and eco-hospitality. We set an example through our research and teaching facility, Centro Madroño, and we even provide the ranchers with financing to convert if they need it. We buy land, although mostly from absentee ranchers, and only when it is the sole option for getting cows off it. Our goal is to help everyone create a new forest and watershed-based economy. Nathan parked the truck at the top of a hill and pointed down into a beautiful valley formed by the Mamoni River. That's where we're going to build Junglewood, a performing and visual arts center. A joint venture between Earth Train and Fundación Danilo Pérez, in cooperation with Boston's Berklee College of Music, Junglewood is loosely modeled after Tanglewood, the summer home of the Boston Symphony Orchestra in the Berkshire Mountains of western Massachusetts. Danilo's friends, Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock, are among several popular musicians who are committed to helping him realize his dream of turning this place into Mother Nature's ultimate tropical rehearsal space and a music camp for kids. He shifted into four-wheel drive and headed along the ridge. We're engaging top architects and artisans to create a place where accomplished artists and talented kids can reconnect with nature. Here's where they'll come to work on new compositions and use their music to inspire and teach folks from all over and form bridges with indigenous and local people. Jane Goodall will arrive for a visit later this year. She's considering setting up a center in Panama to teach teachers. This evening, you'll meet Dr. Catherine Lindell, a Michigan State professor who is using this place as a living laboratory to study the effects of land cover restoration on the behavior of birds. He grinned. Aren't you glad I persuaded you to come? It was a reference to my attempts to resist him. When he first called me, I had been facing an August deadline for completing this book, and I did not see how I could fit a trip to Panama's jungles into my schedule. Nathan had assured me that I would understand once I got there. The night before, at an event right after my arrival in this country where I had once spent so much time as an EHM, Nathan had been proven right. Earth Train hosted a reception for Lynn and me. It was held on the rooftop garden of their offices in the colonial section of Panama City, just a couple of blocks from the presidential palace and the old wall where Omar Torrijos and I had strolled that day all those many years ago. We were joined by CUNA chiefs and NGO leaders, as well as Danilo Perez and many other dignitaries. And we were treated to a slideshow presentation for the new Bridge of Life Biomuseo that will be housed in a building designed by world-renowned architect Frank O. Gehry and constructed on a promontory of land that used to be part of the U.S.-occupied canal zone. Behind us were the lights of ships anchored in the bay, waiting to sail from the Pacific through the canal into the Atlantic. And in front of us were slides flashing on a screen, while we were told by the museum executive director, Leader Sucre, that Panama had been formed as a bridge of life between North and South America around 3 million years ago. Before that time, the two oceans had been joined. Panama's creation had changed everything. The land masses were united and the oceans divided. The flora, fauna, and environments of both land and water were forever altered. The entire planet was impacted by the changes in global ocean currents and climate. Later that night, as I walked back to the apartment where I was staying, through the ancient winding streets, an observation by one of the CUNA elders kept running through my mind. "Here in Panama," he said, "the great creator made a bridge across the oceans. Then the Yankees came and tore a hole in that bridge with a canal. Since then, we have all been divided. People from nature, people from each other, north from south, east from west. Everything went crazy. It is up to us to build a new type of bridge." Nathan drove the pickup through a small gate and into the Centro Madroño, a cluster of small open-air cottages and a couple of large meeting lodges scattered amidst one of the preserved sections of luxuriant rainforest. After showers and a brief rest, Lynn, Emilio, Nathan, and I made our way to dinner. A group had assembled in the dining hall. The diversity of the people was representative of the organization. There was a young leader of the Embera, Raul Mezua, and one from the CUNA, Toniel Edmond. Their two tribes are traditional enemies that have now united to try to save their threatened lands and cultures, and they had become comrades in this crusade to reverse the destruction of the Darien ecoregion. Also present were a former local cattle rancher turned environmentalist, Rolando Toribio, a young lawyer, Carlos Andres, who had decided to forego the big bucks in favor of doing something that makes my heart sing, and a representative from Global Brigades, the world's largest student-led health and sustainable development organization, Alan Gula. During the ensuing conversations, Lynn referred to the CUNA elder's observation at the reception on the roof overlooking the bay the evening before. "This concept of building a new bridge," she told the group, "is part of the prophecy of the eagle and condor." "Please," Nathan coaxed, "recite it." "As far as we can tell," she replied, "this prophecy originated in the Amazon over 2,000 years ago. It traveled up into the Andes, then across this isthmus, influencing the legends of the Maya, Aztecs, Hopi, and many North American tribes. In summary, it says that during ancient times, human societies divided into two groups. The Condor people represented the path of the heart, adhering to the ideals of the deep feminine, opting for lifestyles that create peaceful, sustainable environments favorable for giving birth, raising families, and passing knowledge about the natural world to their children. The Eagle people followed the path of the mind, advocating values we associate with masculine traits, creating societies that develop technologies for conquering other tribes and dominating nature. According to this prophecy, the two paths would converge during the fourth Pachacuti. Pachacuti is a Quechua Incan word designating a 500-year period beginning in the 1490s. There would be wars, terrible violence, and the eagle would drive the condor to the verge of extinction. Lynn glanced around the table. "Of course, we know that is exactly what happened after Columbus's voyage. The prophecy was realized. The industrial cultures of the world practically destroyed the indigenous ones. Then, according to the prophecy, 500 years later, starting in the 1990s, a new Pachacuti would begin, the fifth. It is said to be a time when the condor and the eagle have the opportunity to reunite. This is not a given, as we must make it happen, but the opportunity exists for the eagle and condor, mind and heart, to soar together in the same sky, dancing, mating, and restoring balance. She glanced at Toniel and Raoul, and then, spreading her arms, embraced everyone at the table. It is happening. We're seeing it in so many parts of the world. The condor people sharing their wisdom, and the eagle people trying to repair the damage we have wrought. Look at what's going on right here. We are that bridge we heard about during the slideshow last night, Christine Delvecchio, an Earth Train organizer, added. We in Panama are dancing the eagle-condor dance. The Mamoni Valley Preserve, I said, is a place to incubate dreams. The old dream was based on exploiting, conquering nature and people. The new one is about living in harmony. I went on to tell them that I had always thought the prophecy is about a sort of evolution, elevating human cultures to a new level of consciousness where heart and mind are truly integrated. This current economic crisis, I said, is no fluke. It had to happen to shake us awake. The incredible vision that is materializing in the Mamoni Valley Preserve was juxtaposed by the political turmoil sweeping another Central American country in July 2009. Everyone I talked with in Panama was convinced that the military coup that had overthrown the democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, had been engineered by two U.S. companies with CIA support. Earlier in the year, Chiquita Brands International, Inc., formerly United Fruit, and Dole Food Company, Inc., had severely criticized President Zelaya for advocating an increase of 60% in Honduras' minimum wage, claiming that the policy would cut into corporate profits. Memories are short in the United States, but not in places like Panama. Whether I chatted with men planting trees in the Darien ecoregion, taxi drivers, waiters, and shopkeepers in Panama City, or the movers and shakers I met at the rooftop reception, I kept hearing people who claimed that it was a matter of record that Chiquita, United Fruit, and the CIA had toppled Guatemala's democratically elected president Jacobo Arbenz in 1954, and that International Telephone and Telegraph, ITT, Henry Kissinger, and the CIA had brought down Chile's Salvador Allende in 1973. These people were certain that Haiti's president Jean-Bertrand Aristide had been ousted by the CIA in 2004 because he proposed a minimum wage increase, like President Zelaya's. I was told by a Panamanian bank vice president who wanted to remain anonymous, every multinational knows that if Honduras raises its hourly rate, the rest of Latin America and the Caribbean will have to follow. Haiti and Honduras have always set the bottom line for minimum wages. The big companies are determined to stop what they call a leftist revolt in this hemisphere. In throwing out Zelaya, they are sending frightening messages to all the other presidents who are trying to raise the living standards of their people. It did not take much imagination to envision the turmoil sweeping through every Latin American capital. There had been a collective sigh of relief at Barack Obama's election in the United States, a sense of hope that the empire in the North would finally exhibit compassion toward its southern neighbors, that the unfair trade agreements, privatizations, draconian IMF structural adjustment programs, and threats of military intervention would slow down and perhaps even fade away. Now that optimism was turning sour. The cozy relationship between Honduras's military coup leaders and the corporatocracy was confirmed a couple of days after my arrival in Panama. England's Guardian ran an article announcing that two of the Honduran coup government's top advisors have close ties to the U.S. Secretary of State. One is Lanny Davis, an influential lobbyist who was a personal lawyer for President Bill Clinton and also campaigned for Hillary. The other hired gun for the coup government that has deep Clinton ties is lobbyist Bennett Ratcliffe. Democracy Now! Broke the news that Chiquita was represented by a powerful Washington law firm, Covington & Burling LLP, and its consultant, McLarty Associates. President Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder, had been a Covington partner and a defender of Chiquita when the company was accused of hiring assassination squads in Colombia. Chiquita was found guilty, admitting that it had paid organizations listed by the U.S. government as terrorist groups for protection, and agreeing in 2004 to a $25 million fine. George W. Bush's U.N. Ambassador John Bolton, a former Covington lawyer, had fiercely opposed Latin American leaders who fought for their people's rights to larger shares of the profits derived from their resources. After leaving the government in 2006, Bolton became involved with the Project for the New American Century, the Council for National Policy, and a number of other programs that promote corporate hegemony in Honduras and elsewhere. McLarty Vice Chairman John Negroponte was the U.S. Ambassador to Honduras from 1981 to 1985, a former Deputy Secretary of State, Director of National Intelligence, and U.S. Representative to the United Nations. He played a major role in the U.S.-backed Contras secret war against Nicaragua's Sandinista government, and he has consistently opposed the policies of the democratically elected pro-reform Latin American presidents. These men symbolize the insidious power of the corporatocracy, its bipartisan composition, and the fact that the Obama administration has been sucked in. Holder, Bolton, and Negroponte are among the more visible representatives of a cadre of influential men and women who are determined to maintain a status quo that has brought us to the perilous edge of global collapse. They and the many others who serve them trace their heritage back to the beginnings of EHM and Jackal operations in Iran and Indonesia. They prefer to implement their policies quietly, behind closed doors, but they do not hesitate to draw on the military when all else fails, or when they feel that there is simply not enough time for the more subtle approaches. The Los Angeles Times went to the heart of this matter when, on July 23, 2009, it concluded the following. What happened in Honduras is a classic Latin American coup in another sense. General Romeo Vasquez, who led it, is an alumnus of the United States School of the Americas, renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. The school is best known for producing Latin American officers who have committed major human rights abuses, including military coups. As I sat in my little open-air cottage in the Darien ecoregion in July 2009, reading the articles about Honduras, I kept recalling how vehemently Omar Torrijos had opposed this type of clandestine empire building. It degrades the United States, he said. It makes a mockery of democracy. He himself had attended the School of the Americas, located in the U.S.-occupied Panama Canal Zone in those days, and he understood its sinister implications. He referred to it as the School of the Assassins. Once he became Panama's head of government, he demanded that the United States remove the school from his country. As part of the Canal Treaty, the Pentagon transferred it to Fort Benning, Georgia. Late one afternoon, I wandered along a river trail and into a clearing at the top of a hill. The Mamoni River snaked through the valley below. I sat down on a log and thought about the classic war that had pitted supporters of John Maynard Keynes against those of Milton Friedman. The latter's victory had changed the world and brought on the crisis we now face. It seemed that today, here, on this relatively small stretch of land between North and South America, a new war was raging. One battle in Honduras was making headlines. It was being waged with the traditional corporatocracy weapons, a military coup to replace a legitimately elected president who refused to succumb to EHM bribes and threats, A U.S. public relations blitz, similar to ones previously employed to justify imperialism in the name of democracy in so many countries, and a battery of extremely influential lawyers and lobbyists whose cannons were aimed at the courts, Congress, and the United Nations to defend Chiquita, Dole, and their allies. The word had been broadcast across network television and the mainstream newspapers in the United States that President Zelaya had tried to usurp the electoral process by announcing that his government would conduct a poll to determine popular sentiments regarding the extension of presidential term limits. Hundreds of millions of dollars had poured into the media and the halls of Washington to keep the public ignorant about the real reason behind the military takeover. President Zelaya had the audacity to expose the terrible working conditions on the agribusiness plantations, the suffering and diseases, the low wages and malnutrition among those who raise the bananas and pineapples that grace our breakfast tables, and that he had the integrity not to bend to corruption, but instead to demand something better for his people. Honduras was a battle fought to defend the mutant virus form of capitalism. Another battle, the one in Panama, was quietly being waged with a new array of weapons. Seeds, hoes, and sustainable agricultural techniques, socially conscious capital, music, a melding of indigenous wisdom with scientific research, and a squadron of former cattle ranchers, community organizers, ecologists, artists, writers, NGOs, web designers, a new wave of lawyers, and people young and old from many other walks of life who were coming together to take their place in forging an innovative, healthy form of capitalism. The old war between Keynes and Friedman might seem a relic of the past, the recession its tombstone. However, the corporatocracy was not standing quietly beside the grave. Their candidate had not won the U.S. presidential race, but their people had quickly infiltrated some of the most influential offices in the White House, Federal Reserve, Pentagon, and State Department. Their bankers had marched back to Wall Street and were once again paying themselves unearned bonuses. Although the IMF had fallen into disrepute in the early and mid-2000s, the G20 countries had infused it with more than triple its previous capital and awarded it new mandates for power in 2008 and 2009. And as if to let the world know that the recession, the tombstone, was merely a warning and not symbolic of a real death, the EHMs and jackals had drawn a line in the sands of Honduras. We are all arrayed along that line. It is up to each of us to decide. Do we want a world ruled by a few billionaires, intent on controlling the planet's resources with the goal of serving their increasingly voracious appetites? Do we want more debt, privatization, and markets where robber barons elevate themselves above the rules and regulations that apply to the rest of us? Accounting systems that fail to record the most egregious costs? Magazine cover heroes who exploit their workers, pay fortunes to lawyers and lobbyists to defend the status quo, and ship their money to overseas tax havens? Do we want to buy from corporations that finance the overthrow of democratically elected governments, undermine our own president and elected officials? Do we want to raise our children on a planet where less than 5% of the population consumes more than 25% of the resources? Less than 10% of that 5% control the assets, and roughly half the world lives in poverty, where violence continues to rise, and our militaristic tactics against terrorism force us into a constant state of siege? Or do we want something else? Do we want a world envisioned by the organizations that are striving to create a socially and environmentally responsible economy? The type of organizations we find at green festivals, local markets, in stores, and on websites that are committed to the triple bottom line? Do we want a world where the models for our children are the founders and managers of institutions that restore rainforests and polluted lakes, promote sustainable energy, and help starving people feed themselves. Where no one is denied medical care and the right to live out the last days of his or her life in dignity? In short, do we want to break the old pattern, rid ourselves of the viral form of predatory capitalism that is failing us so badly, and bequeath a world to future generations that reflects the ideals of true democracy, a world headed towards sustainable, just, and peaceful societies for us all? This choice does not lie with Barack Obama, or John McCain, or any other politician. The choice is ours. This is David Aykroyd. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Hoodwinked, An Economic Hitman Reveals Why the World Financial Markets Imploded and What We Need to Do to Remake Them, by John Perkins. This program was directed by Sean Runette, executive producers Orly Moskowitz and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2009 by John Perkins. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.